exception.
It's an exception.
Whereas in Islam, it's the rule.
It's the rule.
Okay? Mm. Again, I mean, if you want to go about the prophets, well, Prophet David and Suleiman, you know, they were kings. They were leaders of militaries.
Peace be upon them.
You know, so this is, you know, nobody should say that we're making up stuff.
No, we are not.
We're not saying that that's the only thing they did, but this is part of their job, and some of them more than others.
More than others, yes.
So, you know, it is in that school and in that dynasty, if you want to put it, in that chain of leaders that we see Imam acting the way he does and doing the things he does. Yes.
And which is really amazing.
Right, and you see it before the revolution in terms of leading the revolutionary movement.
Movement, yeah.
And some of the things he does,
yes,
which completely, you know, just confusing the Shah and the Savak and the Americans and just not knowing what, you know.
They hadn't a clue what was going on.
So in the end, they're like, okay, we've got to exile you.
Yeah.
And then when they're in Turkey, they're like, no, it's too dangerous. Go to Najaf, you know, go to Iraq.
Yes.
In Iraq, they're like, wait a second, he was supposed to go there and, you know, be swallowed up by all the other ulama,
yeah.
And yet he's become one of the main
ustads.
Yeah. Mm. And people are flocking to his teachings, and he has good relations with all the ulama. And,
yes, absolutely.
I think for me, some of the key events that show what I'm talking about, or the thing that I think is important.
Yes,
is,
I mean, if
is
you related, a couple of examples for us.
Right, I think it's related to that transition period where, you know, the Shah has left, and it's time for Imam to come. But we have that Bakhtiari government
that was appointed by the Shah.
Bakhtiari was
right.
There. Shapur Bakhtiari was he was appointed as prime minister.
Yes.
And so at that time, you really see his, you know, political vision and capabilities. Mm. Because it is at these moments where people get fooled by the enemy.
Yes.
Where hearts weaken. Where people think, hey, we've got what we wanted. And this is how, for example, they, you know, roll back revolutions. If you look at what happened
in Egypt, yes.
If you look at other places throughout history. So, you know, what do you want? If you don't have a real leader,
yeah.
If you don't have a leader in the mold of Ahlul Bayt,
quite.
And not in the mold of the Khulafa, you're not going to really get anywhere.
No. And this is what we're seeing.
And this is the point about Imam, which is, you know, at that time, Bakhtiar gets appointed. There's the so-called, you know, whatever, provisional, transitional. It wasn't provisional. It was like, you know, the new government. People were saying, well, you wanted the Shah to leave, so he's left.
He's left.
Why don't you, you know, you got what you wanted.
Wanted, yes.
Now, this itself shows how naive some of them were, because that's not what Imam wanted.
No.
He certainly
didn't want that for a moment.
That was just the first step.
That was the first step, yes.
Okay, it's not about, okay, the Shah left, let's have some dude, you know, appointed by the Shah who's... Mm. And, you know, remember Bakhtiar, what kind of person he was. I mean, he was French. He was basically a French guy.
Was he?
Well, he was Bakhtiar, and then he lived in France for most of his life. And
right.
He was part of the...
I wasn't aware of that.
He was part of the French resistance during the war.
Was he?
Yes. God. And his wife was French, and, you know, he was just a French dude masquerading as an Iranian.
Right.
And the French were quite happy to have him there, because all these years it was the British or the Americans that had Iran hands, and now it was one of their guys.
Guys in there.
And remember, Imam was in Paris.
Yes.
You know, the French thinking, you know what, this is a good opportunity for us to, you know, take over Iran. Take it away from the Americans.
And the British.
Right.
Yeah.
So these were the things they were thinking. The Americans were thinking, well, if this guy's in power, we'll have the military, because the military always had close relations with the U.S. Even though he's French, at least he's Western aligned. We don't have to worry about the communists and the Russians and the Soviets. And we have our own generals and officers that can, you know, take things into their hands if it gets out of control. Sure. So everybody was, Americans and the French were quite happy.
Happy, yes.
They were ready to, you know, make the compromises necessary and, you know, give the Shah whatever, you know, so that he would shut up and go away and, you know, continue as before.
Yes.
In terms of, you know, cheap oil from you, you know, expensive products into your market from us.
Us, yes.
You know, destruction of your local history and culture and religion and, you know, our Hollywood, you know, modern culture and whatever into your
dish.
So they were quite happy to continue that.
Sure.
And in the end, you know, maintain our bases in the south of the Caspian Sea against the Soviets and all that stuff.
Right.
In terms of the Cold War.
Cold War, yes.
Situation. maintaining Iran as a fortress.
Bulwark against the Soviet
against
Union.
The Soviet South.
Soviet
flank,
South,
whatever.
Yes. Yeah.
And, you know, preventing them from coming into the Persian Gulf and the oil fields and, you know, whatever. So all this was happening. And basically, a couple points here. The Americans, we've mentioned this before, but it's really worth repeating. It's a very interesting story. Ebrahim Yazdi, who was one of the leaders of the freedom movement, who were, you know, religious, but they really weren't that into Velayat Faqih, and they weren't into the clerical, you know, had the clergy having a part. They were basically, in their view, they were personally religious, but they were secular in the way they viewed, you know, religion and politics.
Sure.
They were part of that crew. He was in Paris, and the American always had good relations with the Americans, you know, lived in Houston for many years.
Sure.
Still goes back and forth there. He basically, the Americans sent a message through him to Imam saying that, and he said it himself. This is not something, you know, we're not making stuff up. He said it himself in a BBC program. So, you know, there you go. It's him in BBC program saying this.
Sure.
As the source of what we're saying. He said that the Americans sent a message to Imam through me saying that, you know, just accept the Bakhtiar government and this new government, and, you know, you got what you wanted, the Shah's left, just go to Qom, you know, make your proclamations, but don't get involved in the daily affairs, and Bakhtiar will take care of things. And if you don't do that, we will tell the military to make a coup d'etat, and we will support the, you know, the Savak and the secret police in Iran to arrest all of you guys and execute you. Okay. So my question to you is, what would most leaders do at that point?
Compromise.
They would be like, okay, fine. We'll go, we'll do it. So what did Imam say?
He said, I'll declare a jihad.
He said, if you do that, I will declare a jihad.
Which really threw everyone.
Right. Now, it's interesting because, first of all, when Yazdi was saying this on BBC, you could tell after 35, 40, whatever, 36 years, he's still angry.
Mm.
He's still upset that Imam did this.
Because
he was thinking, well, this is what ruined everything, and if we would just had that, and whatever.
Yeah.
All these things. But I think what it shows is basically Imam, you know, not being intimidated.
Mm.
Because he relies on God. He doesn't care about the American army and the Iranian officers and the Savak. And I think it just shows that, you know, when he says that, well, Americans could have been like, okay, fine, let's you know, bring it on.
Yeah,
right?
Bring it on.
But I think they realized that bringing it on with a person like Imam with all those followers and him declaring jihad would mean, you know, they would lose.
They would lose.
So it's not simply about, you know, him standing up. It's him telling them, you're the ones that are going to lose.
If you're going to do this.
It's not about, you know, this is the thing. We, unfortunately, Muslims, and the whole point of what I'm trying to say here is that, you know, what we're lacking in the Muslim world is leaders like Imam.
Yes. That are so decisive.
Okay. Which are key to this matter. Our issue has always been, you know, who is the leader of Islam?
Exactly.
Okay. Thank God we've had people like Imam. Thank God we have people like the Supreme Leader. Thank God we have people like Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah. Right?
But they have come out of that.
And let me just say this. And you know, that's about it.
That's about it, yeah.
Okay?
Unfortunately.
I mean, we don't really have
much more than this.
Right? And it's a shame because, you know, if you had 3, 4, 5, 10 other guys like that, a lot of things would be different in the Muslim world.
They would be.
You know, there would not be as much oppression. There would not be as much injustice. There would not be as much, you know, devious plans and you know, things that are happening with the enemies of Islam. And Muslims themselves becoming tools of the enemies of Islam within the Ummah.
Sure.
If you have clear, smart, decisive leadership who understands the events and understands them not only from a worldly perspective but from a Quranic and Islamic perspective.
Which
so
is
when
the
something
key.
Happens, they immediately understand that this is how the Quran is explaining to you what this is. Who understands the consequences in the next world. Who knows what the lines are. Who knows? This is why we talk about Velayat Faqih.
Sure.
Why Faqih? Because a Faqih knows the rules and the laws.
Laws, yes.
Okay? We don't want just some philosopher or some, you know, great whatever person who can recite the Quran very well.
Yeah.
We're talking about somebody who knows the lines as it relates to what is prohibited and what is allowed in Islam.
Sure.
Because these are reflections of the reality of what is right and what is wrong.
No, exactly.
This is not some random line drawn by God to annoy us and to make life difficult for us.
No.
It's a reflection of what is actually right and wrong. When you're talking about how you deal with non-Muslims, there are laws concerning that.
Right. Yes.
When you're dealing with, you know, war and how you deal in war, there are laws concerning that, and you need to know these things.
Exactly.
And because they are reflections of the reality of whether you're going to be successful or not.
Exactly.
Again, I use the example of the chemical weapons. Well, people say you should have used chemical weapons. We say no, we shouldn't have. And in fact, in the long run, this was good for us.
Sure.
We didn't use chemical weapons when they attacked us with chemical weapons. Mm-hmm. And in the long run, this was of great benefit to the Islamic Republic.
I mean, let's not...
We're not even mentioning the otherworldly aspects of it, of not having used these weapons on other human beings, which who knows what the...
Yeah, the consequences
of that will be in the next world.
But to be honest, Dr. Mahdi Tarabi, I mean, let us not forget the fact that Iran in the 1980s had the capability of retaliating on a mass scale with Iraq. I mean... The thing not only was the fact that Imam was so visionary in terms of even how he reinvented the army. You know, I mean, he created the besieged forces. He created
kinds
of institutions which,
to this day,
you know, terrify the United States of America.
I think you make a good point, and the army is a good point, and let me get to that
Please.
In a moment.
Yeah, yeah.
This is another example, a very good example that you put. Once he is in Iran... Mm. So first, he is not intimidated by the threats of the Americans about, you know, accept this. And he comes to Iran, he gets off the plane, and he goes to Beishtara, and he says, you know, in very not usual for a clergyman, he says,
I will smash the teeth of this.
I will sock this government into the mouth with, you know.
But, yes.
Okay, basically, yes. Why? Because this is... it's not a legal government.
It's not a legal government.
It was appointed by a person who himself was not legally allowed to rule.
Rule, yes.
Okay, as a king, you know, in a coup d'etat by his father, there's no legal basis. The only legal basis is if there is a, you know, hukm by the ulama allowing that ruler, whether it's the ulama themselves or another ruler being appointed by the ulama or being
approved. And this is also another point that, you know, which you quite nicely inferred to, which is the fact that the Imam Khomeini saw the validity of the entire system of Iran through the ballot box. So
through Islam,
in
the sense that you saw what happened in Egypt.
Yeah.
These guys came into power, the so-called Islamists, and yet they were playing the game of the previous regime.
Exactly.
So with the same rules, they overthrew them.
Exactly.
So Imam said, I don't even play your game.
Game.
It doesn't matter who appointed you. That person who appointed you was not legitimate to begin with. So you're not legitimate.
Legitimate, yes.
Get out of here.
Get out of here.
Okay. Mm. And he said it. And so at that time, they declared military rule.
Mm.
They said after, I think, 3 or 4 o'clock in the afternoon, nobody's allowed to be in the streets.
Right.
Okay. Which was ridiculous. I mean, what is that supposed to mean?
Sure.
Right. And they were saying, oh, we're going to send the military. Anybody out will be shot, blah, 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 all that stuff.
Mm.
At that, so that level, he's not intimidated by the threats by the U.S. He comes to Iran. He says that I'm going to sock them in the mouth, and we're going to create our own government.
Exactly.
I will appoint a government, which was then the Revolutionary Council, and then which later, 2 months later, you had the first elections and the elections for the Constitutional Assembly. And so what is the reaction of the government? They declare martial law.
Sure.
And they say nobody's allowed to leave, be in the streets after 4 o'clock.
Sure.
So what does Imam do?
He says, come out in the streets.
I mean,
yeah.
I think this is maybe even more hardcore than, you know, standing up to the Americans.
This is the point we're trying to make here, that Imam Khomeini does those things which really, you know, stunned everybody. Nobody knew how to react. I mean, they were just confused.
You know, this one was so intense that even some of the ulama around him were like, hey, wait a second.
Wait a minute.
You know, well, this is going to be a problem.
This is going to be a sauce.
And he said, it's not going to be a problem.
A problem.
People came out. It wasn't, yes, there were some shootings, but it wasn't that mass.
That mass slaughter,
you know, because you got to remember at that time, I mean, these people who were running it, whether it was the security services, the army, they themselves were, half of them, revolutionary.
Sure.
Most of the army, this brings me to the army, because we were talking about the army.
Yes, yes.
So it wasn't like they were these, you know, guys just trigger happy waiting to kill their fellow brothers and sisters and cousins and aunts and uncles.
Sure.
I mean, they're all part of the same society.
Society, yes.
So Imam realizes this.
Yes, he knows this, yeah.
Okay. Unlike mm-hmm. Bakhtiar and unlike, you know, General so-and-so and, you know...
These elites who hate
officer,
the people.
You know, Colonel so-and-so in mm-hmm. the U.S., mm-hmm. he realizes that, you know, these are the same people. They're not going to shoot each other. Right? So 4 o'clock rolls around and he says, okay, everybody go out. And they go out.
Yeah.
And the whole dynamic changes.
Exactly.
Because there's no shootings, there's no mass killings. I mean, there's no mass killings. There's some shootings, but there's no mass killings. You see the demonstrators putting the
flowers,
carnations into the
and
the flowers into the rifles. And, you know, basically half the army, you know, coming over to the
to Imam Khomeini's
right?
Side,
I mean, you know, the army suddenly, you see, like, all the enlisted men, basically all of them from, you know, poor religious backgrounds are like, hey, we're not going to do something that's against what Imam has ordered.
Order.
You know? So.
Fantastic.
This is another aspect. Mm. The army itself, mm. another of the brilliant moves mm. of Imam. Mm. Many people in the revolutionary movement demanding the abolition.
Yeah, abolition, dismemberment of the army.
Of the army. Mm. Imam, from day one, said, we're not going to do this.
Do that.
You know, this is our army. We need this army. It's part of our power. It's part of our ability to defend our borders. This is, you know, they are our own sons. He had this famous line. He said, Agha means Lord, mm. you know, master. He said, you can be your own masters. You don't need the American advisors. You yourself are capable of doing all these things.
Yes.
And we saw that in the war, this was the case.
That's right.
Okay.
That's right.
So from the very beginning, he mm. knew that he has to... you know, that the army is not separate from the people. Mm. This is very important because the Shah has desperately claimed trying to turn the army into his own personal army.
Personal army.
So what he would do is he would, you know, get those officers, those generals, and those colonels that were, you know, very loyal to him. They would give him extra privileges, so on and so forth. Mm. But what he didn't realize is that the body of the army was, you know, the normal enlisted men, the junior officers.
Of course they were.
Even some of the higher-ranking officers.
Yeah.
Who
were all of the people.
Were from the people.
Mm.
But Imam understood this,
mm.
unlike many of the revolutionary forces who didn't, who said this has to be, you know, dissolved and we will be the new army and so on and so on and so forth. Mm. At the same time, he's smart enough to realize, well, the revolution needs its own army as well, so he creates Sepah. He creates the Revolutionary Guards.
Yes.
So these are all examples of capable, visionary, decisive leadership by somebody who's leadership training, if you want to put it that, whose leadership course was, you know, conducted by the school of Ahlul Bayt.
Exactly.
You know,
exactly.
Where this is the key here.
Yeah.
You know, he wasn't, you know, didn't go to university, some Western university. He didn't go to some officer training school. He didn't go to some, you know, management guru who was going to tell him what to do, which unfortunately we see a lot of Muslims, you know, they're Muslim. They do everything in their life as Muslims. And then when it comes to these things, they're like, well, what does the management theory tell us? What is, you know, come on,
I mean,
you know,
exactly.
Go and see how the Prophet did things. Look at how the Imams, you know, managed the affairs.
Yes.
And you do it the same way.
Exactly.
With the same spirit, with the same understanding. Of course, it takes time to understand it, to read it, to learn it. So this is not something that happens overnight. Your personality.
But the results are amazing.
One's personality is also a factor in it.
Yes.
Some people are born leaders. Others are, you know, less so.
Yes.
So if you have those abilities, you need to do it in the school of Ahlul Bayt in order to be a real Muslim leader.
One other key point that, you know, you remind me of in terms of what you said about, you know, the people coming out at 4 o'clock when Bakhtiar had declared martial law in Iran. And that, for me, you know, is also key in terms of the Quranic thinking of the Imam.
Mm-hmm.
Because he comes right out of the Quran, you know.
Right.
It's right out of the verses of the Quran. Because, you know, first of all, martyrdom is not something that is a death or an end for somebody. This is the beginning of something far greater, something much
dead.
More. And this is what he tells the Americans. That, look, don't threaten me.
Right.
Don't do that to me.
Right.
We are people who are going to sit here and to the last drop of my blood will fight for what we believe in.
Exactly.
And if you do that to us, you will see an earthquake in this region like you've never seen it before.
Right.
And these people are going to lay down their lives for what they believe in, and you are going to be the loser. He said, fear is not in our vocabulary.
Yeah.
It's our enemies who are fearful.
I remember he said, you people who have God what are you scared of?
What are you scared of? Exactly. Why does fear enter
you? You have God.
You have God.
Right?
Trust in
God.
And
this was important, I think, in the history of Islam. Mm. And in terms of, you know, the growth of Islam and the revival of Islam is to have a leader like him who reminded us of what the Quran really tells us.
Fearless leaders,
you know, millions and millions and tens of millions of Muslims, they recite the Quran every day, but do they think about it, what they're saying? You know, recitation's a good thing. We all should do it. I'm not saying we shouldn't do it, but the key is that when you recite it, you think about what the Quran is saying. Mm. So this is what Imam did in the most clear and beautiful way. Mm. He said, you know, this is what we're going to do. And again, remember, you know, in this case that we talked about in terms of him managing the army during the revolution, this just shows the moderation that he actually had. Mm. That he wasn't this, you know, radical dude who was just going to come throw everything up.
Throw everything out, right?
The main instrument of the Shah's power, which was the army, he, contrary to the pressures that were put on him by the other revolutionary forces, said, no, we're going to keep them. They're our sons. They are part of us. Mm. You know, it's not about throwing everything into the garbage. No. It's about reforming.
Revamping it.
And reforming. This is what Islam does.
Exactly.
This is the way Islam does it.
Exactly.
Islam doesn't come with the...
Because that's why that photograph, that very famous Ionic image that I remember with the Air Force all saluting the Imam.
Well, basically, this was... Exactly. And that's really the turning point in the revolution.
It was.
Where basically, because the Air Force was, even within the military branches, the Air Force was like...
Because they were all trained by the Americans, wasn't it?
Right. They were considered the elite of the elite.
Okay?
They were considered... They were all like, you know... trained by the Americans. This was where all the best equipment went. This is where everything, you know, the top officer candidates goes to the Air Force. So the Air Force was the top.
Sure.
And here you have all these Air Force. It was about 300, I think a little bit more than 300 of the Air Force officers coming and pledging allegiance to Imam.
Exactly.
In full uniform.
Wonderful. And the thing was that, of course, that Ionic image, as I say, was so powerful, so significant, because it played a vital role in the 8-year holy defense.
Well, it also was a message to the Americans and the world that you can't rely on the army or the air force to, you know, make a coup d'etat and, you know, pull out of the fire, you know?
Exactly.
It was basically them saying, you know, we who are all Western American trained, who speak fluent English, and, you know, who you were counting on to be your, you know, main agents in Iran forever.
Yes, I just made pay it to
we,
Imam.
We just pledged allegiance to Imam. Okay? So it was not only internally important, it was internationally very important.
Exactly.
So this is the lessons that we can learn from all that.
Thank you, Dr. Mahdi Tarabi, for that valuable contribution on the man who changed the world. Really, it was a very powerful contribution there. Thanks very much for that, as it always is. And it just leaves me to thank our listeners, and I hope they enjoyed the program. And it leaves me to say, Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. May the peace and mercy and blessings of Allah be upon you all. Thank you for listening, and goodbye.
Heard of Iran's stellar wrestling achievements or about its soccer team, but that's not all. Another sport has grabbed attention too. Golfers now competing during Iran's national golf tournament in Tehran. This year, 90 participants from around the country played on a very unique golf course. It has only 13 holes instead of the standard 18, but that hasn't stopped golf enthusiasts playing the 13 holes and then repeating the last five to complete the tournament. The good news is that the golf course might not stay so small for long. Iran's Golf Federation hopes to bring in more people interested in golf. But for this to happen, the infrastructure must be provided first.
We don't have the space to use the 350 instructors to train the 3,000 registered men and women across the country, so we decided to build a national academy off the golf course. Course number 18 will be used in a competition venue during tournaments and as a training and education venue during non-competition times.
When the course was built decades ago in northern Tehran, it had 5 more holes. But over the years, fairways were laid across parts of the field, reducing playable footprint. Tehran's golf club has about 300 members, half are women. Golf has been around in Iran for over a century, and most of the courses are in southern provinces. Concerned about endangered animals? If yes, then it will be good news that a Mexican zoo has welcomed a newborn zebra. It belongs to the most threatened of the 3 species of zebra in the world. The foal made a public appearance Thursday, 10 days after it was born at a zoo in northern Mexico. It's about 50 centimeters tall. Its weight, between 10 to 15 kilograms. The newborn equine raises hopes for the conservation of the imperial zebra species.
We are the only zoo in Mexico that has this species of zebra. Unfortunately, it is an endangered species. Here at the zoo, we are doing everything possible to preserve and produce them so that in the future we can repopulate some other parks.
The imperial zebra is native to Africa. It is the largest of the wild equids, the family of horses, donkeys, and other animals. Currently, there are less than 2,500 of imperial zebras in the wild. That's blamed on the destruction of their habitat, illegal hunting, and lack of food.
The world's largest Ferris wheel has opened to public in the United Arab Emirates. Dubbed the Dubai Eye, the wheel takes the visitors to a height of 250 meters, feasts their eyes on the city skyline. That is almost double the height of the iconic London Eye and over 80 meters taller than the high roller in the U.S. city of Las Vegas. Each full rotation of the giant structure takes 38 minutes. The city put on a spectacular firework and light display to celebrate the opening. The 38th edition of the International Short Film Festival has kicked off in the Iranian capital, with some 63 films from 32 countries competing in the event. The festival has for the first time turned into an Oscar qualifying event, giving winning entries a shot at the Academy Awards. This is being held at Tehran's famous Iran Mall cinema complex, and it will showcase short feature, documentary, and experimental works. 5 Iranian films and 58 from abroad are selected for the grand prize, and the winner will be presented to the Academy for possible Oscar nomination. The jury has members from Iran as well as Italy, Japan, and France. The festival will be running until October 23rd.
Natural disasters often disrupt normal life, but that's not the case with an Indian couple who got married despite their town being submerged by floodwaters. The couple, identified by local media as health workers in Kerala State, managed to reach a temple for the wedding in a giant cooking pot. They could be seen smiling and waving in their ceremonial clothes while 2 of their relatives were steering the pot. The couple reportedly borrowed the pot from the temple, saying that was the only option available. The pair was unwilling to postpone their big day, adding an unforgettable story to a country that is famous for many incredible things. Feeling down, it's all right to cry and get help. That's all what a place called the Crying Room tries to tell its visitors in Spain. The cryo room is part of a building located in central Madrid. It's free and open to the public. The cryo room aims to remove the stigma attached to mental health, crying, and seeking help. It offers a wide range of services, from a corner to crying, to a phone with a list of psychologists people can call. Motivating messages are also visible on the walls. People have hailed the initiative, saying it helps them speak out about their negative emotions.
I think it's an excellent idea to visualize the widespread of the mental health issue. And I think it's a really fun take on it, to call it the crying room, because of the Spanish expression, if you want to cry, go to the crying room. So it's kind of stigmatized to cry in Spain, as in many other countries. So I wanted to take part in this this visualization of the problem.
The crying room was opened in an effort to raise awareness about mental health and well-being. Official data in Spain showed that around 40% of people had symptoms of depression last year. Another 30% experienced anxiety.
The first movie in orbit in the making. Two Russian nationals who traveled to the International Space Station to shoot scenes of that movie are now back on Earth. The Soyuz MS-18 spacecraft carrying an actress and a film director undocked from the ISS early Sunday and successfully touched down in Kazakhstan about 3 hours later. The film crew, along with a veteran astronaut, blasted off from the Russian leased Baikonur Cosmodrome earlier this month. They spent 12 days in the ISS to shoot the scenes. The mission beats a Hollywood movie project starring Tom Cruise. The mission adds to a long list of firsts for Russia's space industry.
The Light is a bulletin in which we bring you a lot of interesting news in different fields like animals' life, cultural events, funny trending news, and more from every corner of the world.
Fabric cuts used to recreate Vietnamese landscapes. A woman living in the capital, Hanoi, has been doing that for 40 years now. The artist, 61 years old, explains what material she uses to create her artworks.
All the details in my artworks are cut from cloth, which is used for oyai, traditional costume, or cut from silk scarves. These are very small details, and I have to get the whole cloth for oyai. I even have to cut them from beautiful silk scarves sent from my friends abroad.
Tuk says sometimes hundreds of thousands of pieces of cloth are needed to shape the scenes. The cuts should be put together very carefully. Besides that, the woman has to work in a room without any air conditioning, even in the boiling summers of Hanoi. That's because, she says, the pieces of cloth are very tiny and would easily be blown away. Her hard work has paid off. The creations sell for up to $5,000. The Vietnamese artist says her work are a summary of the passion and the beauty she has experienced after traveling across her country.
Materials and methods are vital for an artist who combines them to create a masterpiece. Well, a Brazilian artist has used an unusual material to create a huge, dazzling artwork. Mandano has drawn a mural measuring 1,000 square meters using ashes from the burned Amazon rainforest. The artwork on the side of a building in the city of Sao Paulo depicts a firefighter standing near the scenes of deforestation, blazes, and dead animals. Mandano says he traveled extensively to feel that sadness and, more importantly, to collect ashes from for his paintings. He says his aim is to call attention to the environment in his home country, where thousands of wildfires break out each year.
Thank you. the first to catch the balloon. That's what competitors play to win the title at the first Balloon World Cup in Spain. The competition was held in an amusement park in the northeastern city of Tarragona. Participants had to get the balloon to touch the ground before their opponent could touch it. The event was organized by FC Barcelona player Gerard Piqué and a famous web streamer and commentator.
To get out of the comfort zone and try new things. Today we are very proud to have tried something like that and that it has worked so well and that people have enjoyed it. In the end, it's about people having a great time.
The competition was inspired by a trio of American siblings whose balloon game videos had attracted millions of views on TikTok and Instagram. 32 countries competed for the title, and 18-year-old teenager from Peru became the first world champion of this tournament. He defeated his German rival in a 5-minute final match. For those of you with an extreme fear of needles, this may finally be the good news. A group of Dutch researchers say they are working to create painless needle-free injections. The researchers have developed what they call a bubble gun. The device uses a laser to push tiny droplets through the skin. Take a listen to David Fernandez Rivas, the head of the project, explaining how the process is done within a millisecond.
So within a millisecond, the glass that contains the liquid is heated by a laser. A bubble is created in the liquid, pushing the liquid at velocities on the order of 100 kilometers per hour. And we can see the gelatin, how it penetrates about 1 millimeter approximately.
Now, Rivas says the invention will help ease fear of needles and lower the threshold for vaccinations. He believes the new technology can also prevent the risk of contamination through needles and reduce medical waste. If you're eager to get a needle-free shot, you may still have to wait a few more years before they are made available to everyone. From a voyage aboard a fictional spacecraft to a real-life journey to space, a 90-year-old Canadian actor known for his portrayal of a starship captain for decades is now the oldest person ever going to space. After a couple of days of training, William Shatner hitched a ride aboard a suborbital spacecraft on Wednesday. He took off from a Texas desert as a guest alongside three other passengers, two professionals, and a paid customer. During the 10-minute flight, the team experienced more than 3 minutes of weightlessness. Now, listen to the actor describing the voyage as the most unbelievable experience of his life.
I'm so filled with emotion about what just happened. It's extraordinary. I hope I never recover from this. I hope that I can maintain what I feel now. I don't want to lose it.
During a televised journey, the capsule took its four passengers above the maximum altitude of 100 kilometers, a point where the curvatures of the Earth can be seen. With that, the space captain of the entertainment world also broke a record as the oldest space traveler. Now, many see his experience as the embodiment of the space travel promises he made through decades of acting. The population of giant pandas in captivity has reached a record high of 673 in 2021. Official data shows this year 48 panda cubs were born, of which 46 survived. Meanwhile, the total number of overseas giant pandas has reached 69. This is the result of joint efforts by Chinese and foreign researchers following decades of caring for the lovely animals. In July, another study put the number of giant pandas living in the wild at over 1,800. The cute bears were then reclassified from endangered to vulnerable. Experts believe such research improves conservation efforts and facilitates monitoring of animal populations. With the help of artificial intelligence, Beethoven's 10th and last symphony is now completed. A group of German musicologists and programmers started the project over a year ago. They analyzed Beethoven's style and then used algorithms to teach a computer to complete the unfinished job. The work was released to mark the 250th anniversary of the prominent musician's death. The team said they tried hard to solve the puzzle while remaining faithful to Beethoven's process and vision.
I believe that if a composer like Ludwig van Beethoven were to live today, he would probably not only have a large technology team around him to help him, but he would push exactly such technologies and use them for his art. And for me, art is not something that stands fixed in space and is always the same, but that changes with the world, and we can witness that today.
When the German composer died in 1827, he left behind some musical sketches for his 10th symphony. Some experts tried to complete it in the past, but they did not succeed.
Questions and answers on Islamic beliefs.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuhu, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. You are now listening to the program Q&A on Islamic Beliefs. I'm your host, Musa al-Bahadali, and joining me in the studio today is our dear friend and guest speaker, Sheikh Murtada Karimi, who is an Islamic researcher at the Seminary of Qum. Dear Sheikh, I welcome you and assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Wa alaikum assalamu wa rahmatullah, and thank you for having me.
Thank you for joining us, dear Sheikh. Our question today is about foods. Some say that the consumption of pork or wine brings about shamelessness and dishonor. Is this true? Please, in extension of this, tell us of the spiritual effects of food.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. So these are two questions and we need to address them separately. First of all, about whether it is true that the consumption of pork and drinking alcohol brings about shamelessness. When it comes to Islamic laws, especially those which are related to foods and drinks and some of the social Islamic laws, I always tell the people that somehow Islam and all our beliefs are a matter of hierarchy. What do I mean? First of all, I mean, when we are discussing about the philosophy of Islamic laws, first of all, we need to go to the principles. Do you believe in God? So we need to prove the existence of God. Then do you believe in the Prophet? If a person believes in God and believes in the Prophet and believes in Prophet Muhammad as the last Prophet, and believes in the Quran, now he needs to believe in all the verses and the narrations of the Prophet, peace be upon him and his family, and if he's a Shia, in the narrations of the Imams and Lady Fatima Zahra salamullahi alayha.
This is actually a universal rule for all of our rulings that are confirmed to be from an infallible
source. Exactly. By this, I do not mean that, I mean, the Islamic laws have no philosophy and have no logic and reason.
Of course not.
Rather, my point is that if you have come to this understanding that Prophet Muhammad is an infallible imam by God, and his miracle is the noble book of Quran, is the book of God, all of them, all the words of revelation from God. Now, if you have come to this conclusion, then if the Quran tells you that you have no right, I mean, it's forbidden for you to drink alcohol, it means that this is the truth, even if you do not find any philosophy for that. So, although in many cases we are able to find the philosophies and wisdoms, But even if we do not find any philosophy, we need to be the obedient servants of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, because it's been already proved for us that this is all-wise God, this is an infallible prophet, and this is a book free from any kind of mistake and distortion.
This is kind of the whole concept of being a Muslim or Islam, being submissive.
Yeah. So that is why when it comes to the philosophies and wisdom behind the Islamic laws, we have some narrations, we have scholars writing books on it, we have Sheikh Saduq writing Hilal al-Sharayih, and the book is only about the philosophies of the Islamic laws. He has gathered all the narrations about the Islamic laws. But again, we do not claim that we know all the philosophies for the Islamic laws. For some of them, right now we know, some of them may be discovered in the future by the progress of technology.
Right, we are limited by our progress in knowledge and science.
Exactly. And let me just refer to one point. I think I found it in one of the books written by Ayatollah Misbah Yazdi, Rahmatullahi Alayhi, and for me it was very interesting. He said that maybe, I'm paraphrasing of course, maybe one of the philosophies of some of the Islamic laws is to develop the spirit of servitude in us. Like what? For example, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala says that morning prayer is two rak'ah. In the first rak'ah, you have all these details, Fatihatul Kitab, another chapter, Ruku Sujood. So sometimes people question that why morning prayer should be two rak'ah, why should we read and recite this chapter, why Ruku, why Sujood?
Right.
He said that maybe, for some of the Islamic laws, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala mentions different details just to raise the spirit of servitude in you. So that when he mentions the Islamic laws related to social issues, for example, because you have come to this level of servitude before Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, now you are ready to accept them. So he says that, like a father, sometimes I mentioned that, a father, sometimes he orders his children to do some stuff.
Right.
And for them, he doesn't have any, logic. But he just want to raise his children, obedient to him, so that later in their life, if he commands them to do an important job, then they will be obedient. So he's gradually raising them by commanding some insignificant,
educating them also
issues, and just to develop the spirit of obedience toward the parents.
We've actually also seen this concept in some Eastern philosophies, and also, funny enough, some martial arts movies.
Hmm.
When we have also just, for example, a disciple of Buddha, for example, of Buddhism, or in Shintoism, when they have new disciples. From what I'm seeing from documentaries, they ask him to do the most menial task ever, like go clean the floor with this one mop, or go and dust off this place. And they continue for hours, and there's seemingly no reason behind this other than just training the spirit of them.
That was a good example. Of course, by no means I don't want to decrease the value of acts like prayer. There are some philosophies other than that. But according to Ayatollah Misbah Yazdi, for some cases where we do not find any philosophy, at least this is one of the philosophies to raise the spirit of servitude and obeying Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala.
At the very least, it is a suggestion.
Yeah.
Questions and answers on Islamic beliefs on IRIB English Radio. You can send your questions to englishradio@irib.ir. Inshallah, 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 you'll find.
So answering this question, when it comes to the Islamic laws about, for example, eating pork and drinking alcohol, which are forbidden, some people mention some philosophies. For example, when it comes to drinking alcohol, I think all the people, even those people who are used to drink alcohol, they agree that there are some or many harms to it.
Or they know it.
They know it for sure. And that is why we see that in many stores in even Western countries, people under some age are not allowed even to buy, alcoholic beverages.
Like in America, you can go to war, drive a car, but you cannot drink until you're 21 years of age.
Exactly. And if you are, for example, drive while you are intoxicated, then it's a big crime. So I think for drinking alcohol, it's not a big deal, and the Islamic law is very, clear in this regard, and the philosophy behind that.
Right.
But whether it brings about shamelessness or not, it is mentioned in some narrations. For example, it's been mentioned by Sheikh al-Saduq in Al-Amali, page 666, that the people who used to drink alcohol, they lose their somehow chastity and shame, and then they are more ready to commit other sins, like, for example, adultery and so on and so forth. When it comes to pork, again, according to many scholars, I'm not talking about, religious scholars, scholars in science, they believe that there are many harms in eating pork too, because pig is a symbol of a dirty animal, maybe even as viewed by non-Muslims. Some scholars in science believe that there are many, especially germs in the pork, which are very harmful to the body. And maybe this is one of the philosophies for why eating pork is forbidden in Islam. But then some people may claim that we are able to remove all these germs by, for example, increasing the heat, for example.
By cooking it properly.
Yeah.
Right.
So that is why the point is that we need to, pay cautious when we are talking about the philosophies of the Islamic laws.
There are theories, I might add. This is very important because we might say it is a dirty animal, but then research proves it is not a dirty animal, but then it comes again and proves it is a dirty animal.
Yeah.
But we do not, then, just to confirm, we do not have a narration that explicitly says eating pork makes you shameless then.
That's the point.
Okay.
As long as we do not have any authentic proof from our sources, like from the Quran and from the narrations, we just mention these issues as possibilities.
Right. Theories, suggestions.
Theories and suggestions, and not as a definite, verdict from the religion of Islam. So the fact that pig is a dirty animal and the pork has a lot of harmful germs have been proved to some extent in science, and it can be one of the reasons that eating pork is forbidden in Islam.
Right.
Now, the second point is about the spiritual effects of eating food in Islam. It's a very important topic. There are many narrations in this regard. It's a very important topic. When it comes to eating food and also drinking, different halal drinks, there are many narrations which refer to the fact that whatever we consume has a kind of a spiritual effect. The type of food that we consume, the type of halal drink that we drink, it has different effects on your body, on your mental health, and we can discuss that under four titles. One of them is forbidden food, and under five titles. One is eating forbidden food, second is israf or extravagance, third is gluttony, fourth is eating makruh food, or discouraged food, And fifth, the etiquette of eating, and all of them have a kind of a spiritual effect that we need to deal with, inshallah, in the following session.
Inshallah. Dear Sheikh, I thank you for your time and for your insightful knowledge. As usual, we reap great benefit from you. I also thank the dear listeners for tuning in. Yet again, this has been your host, Musa al-Bahadiri, and this was your program, Q&A on Islamic Beliefs. Thank you for tuning in.
إن في الجنة نهرا لبن لعلي وحسين وحسن لعلي وحسين وحسن إن في الجنة نهرا لبن إن في الجنة نهرا لبن لعلي لعلي وحسين وحسن كل من كان محبا لهم كل من كان محبا لهم يدخل الجنة من غير حزن يدخل الجنة من غير حزن إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن لعلي وحسين وحسن
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio.
Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Ask the followers of the remembrance if ye know not.
You're listening to the program The Key on IRIB English Radio with Shiraz Hossein Agha, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Rome and a PhD in philosophy.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Welcome to our program, The Key, here at IRIB English Radio. I'm your host, Shiraz Agha. Thank you for joining us here today. Today we're going to be examining a very important question, and that question is this. People often ask, what is the importance of unity? we should keep one thing in mind, and that is this. We should, in this respect, we should see what the seerah and the conduct of the Ahlul Bayt themselves were in this regard. We know that following the events that occurred after the demise of the Holy Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa alihi wasallam, we know that we are of the belief that the caliphate